Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the monthly meeting, the monthly Zoom meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. We're happy to have you join us today. Actually, we're happy to have you join us anytime and every time that you join us. But today seems like a particularly wonderful day for you to join us. We're less than a week away from Thanksgiving, and then all these major holidays that just seem to come boom, 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 Thanksgiving, Christmas, and then the New Year, and we have Hanukkah in there. I don't remember the date this year, but anyway, there's a lot of things to celebrate. And what I'm going to ask folks to do later on, so maybe you can start thinking about it now, is to think about one thing that you're thankful for, something that you're grateful for in your life. And as I was saying, thank you, Marty, as I was saying earlier, that what I found in my life is, you know, I have a choice. I can basically dwell on the challenges and, oh my gosh, this, that, or the other. Or the other thing that I can do is focus on the things that I'm grateful for, because we all have blessings in our lives. And we all have challenges as too. And I was mentioning earlier that, you know, think about Elon Musk, the wealthiest man on the planet. And right now, I think he's got a lot of challenges with Twitter. And who else knows what else is going on in his life? I can't relate to that. But the fact is that I'm sure even Elon Musk has blessings if he'll only choose to think about it. So if you would, in fact, maybe start thinking about it now. We have some early things to talk about, and then we'll take a break. And anybody who wants to can talk about what they're thankful for. And I, one gentleman just shared that he just recently got off of parole. And so I think that that's certainly something to celebrate and be grateful for. So let's go ahead and start. My name is Janice Bellucci. I am Executive Director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. I'm also a civil rights attorney. And so I will say that sometimes people call me with criminal matters, and I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, but we're really lucky to have with us a criminal defense lawyer, Chance Arborstein. So good morning, Chance.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
Yeah. So, I mean, one difference is if somebody calls me and they have, well, I don't take any calls from custody. If you're in jail or prison, you call me. I just don't take the call because I don't know. I don't know those issues at all. And what happens if you do have somebody in custody and you do have a question about your loved one, most of the time it's better to talk to a criminal defense attorney. And I know one person this morning asked me about her son who's in custody right now, but the question she had was not about while he's in custody, but after he gets out. That I can do, parole conditions, probation conditions, you want to terminate probation early under supervised release, those kinds of questions I can answer. But you have a question about, you think that you pled guilty to the wrong thing, or you were, you know, I don't know. And Chance and I both, by the way, we both work on petitions now here in California, petitions for removal from the registry, and we're going gangbusters. I'm so happy. Chance, I'm just ask you to speak here in just a moment. So happy to get people off the registry. And for every person that I help off the registry, I feel like it's a slave that's being released from a plantation. How do you feel about it, Chance?
I've been doing it for about 10 years, and it's probably the most gratifying thing I do. And, you know, I do have a regular criminal practice, and I represent people throughout the whole gambit of it. So I do everything. But the most precious part of my practice is getting people off the registry, giving them a second chance. And it just makes me feel good. So I dedicate a whole lot of time to doing that. And that's probably not only because it benefits my client, but it actually benefits me. It makes me feel good. So, and that's why I'm here. That is exactly why I'm here.
Excellent. Okay. So before we go to some of the major issues, Chance and I have some things to remind you folks about. One is about scams. And I know, Chance, you brought something up on our board meeting a couple of days ago about somebody who recently fell to one of these scams.
Yeah, actually, he's a very sophisticated guy. He's a business person. He's got everything going in the right direction. Unfortunately, like many folks on the registry, when he hears negative news, he's driven by fear. And what happened is, he got shook up because he got a phone call and he had to go to a kiosk and he had to make a deposit of $6,500. And he called me afterwards and he said, do I need to hire you? I mean, looks like we've got a court date. I told him, I don't think so. I think that's a scam. And, I said, really, you should have called me before. And the basic thing is that when you get approached in these types of situations, You got to slow down a little bit and start to think just common sense. You know, do police act like that? You know, no police officer, no police agency is going to tell you that to post bond, you got to go to a kiosk. Okay. And they're not going to help you post bond. They're going to show up at your doorstep and take you away if they want to, if there's a need to, if there's a reason to, but they're not going to drive you. They're not going to have say, stay on the phone and drive to a kiosk and deposit money. That's just a far reach. And so, you know, the lesson here is, you know, if it doesn't sound just exactly right and you don't really know and you're fearful, call somebody, call an attorney, ask them. And if you don't have enough time to call an attorney, refer them to an attorney. Say, look, I've got to speak to my attorney first, and then I will have them talk to you. Let me have your number or, you know, whatever. But never, never respond like it's an emergency. It's the last minute. Let them drive you to the kiosk and drive you in fear. Never, never, never do that.
And the easiest solution to all this, folks, and it really is an easy solution, is just hang up the phone. And I guess to give a very emotional appeal and scare people out of, you know, down to their toes and saying, we got a car, somebody's going to come pick you up, you know, take you back into custody. And I can understand that nobody wants to go into custody. But on the other hand, just like Chance said, you know, if they're demanding money from you, telling you to go to the kiosk, that's not legitimate. Okay. And again, all you have to do is hang up the phone. And that's one of the things that I understand that they say during the, you know, what after they call you is don't hang up, don't hang up. And I've been told a story by the person that it happened to, so I believe it to be true, which is he went to a bank to withdraw a large amount of cash. And when he was standing there in front of the teller, I guess he was sweating and he just looked upset, shall we say. And the teller, thank goodness, signaled a police officer who happened to be in the bank at that time. And the police officer came over and just started talking to him. You know, he wasn't threatening him at all. He was just talking to him like one human being to another and realized what was going on. And he said, sir, you know, that's a scam. It's a scam. I recommend that you not pay that money. And the guy thanked him. I think it was $10,000. So there's some people out there, folks, there have paid large amounts of money. And once you pay large amounts of money to this shadow figure or figures, you're not going to get it back. So don't think, you know, if you call Chance or you call me that we're going to get the money back from you, because we can't. These people are dishonest. They pretend to be somebody that they're not. And I don't know. I have no idea how to get the money back.
I'm going to give you another example of this. I have a client who now is off the registry. And just a few days ago, same scam. And he called me up and he says, I'm really worried. I think I'm going to go make this deposit. And I said, what are you worried about? He goes, you know, and he told me the details of what they told him. And I said, well, one small thing. You're not on the registry anymore. So what are you worried? How can this even be? And he goes, oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, you know, I mean, you know, the scammers are getting information, some old information and stuff, but they're getting them off the internet. You know, why do they know all these details about me? Well, because they can get it, you know, but that's not how agencies roll. So just be aware of that and be sensitive to it and try not to be driven so much by fear, but by common sense.
And you know what? For the longest time, I thought that the scammers were just after people on the registry, but I read something recently about the Social Security Administration, and the Social Security Administration was basically sending out a notice, and some media outlet picked it up, and people are trying to scam people when it comes to their Social Security, even, and saying that there's something wrong, and you have to pay this money, or, you know, your benefits are going to stop. And so I don't know how sophisticated those scammers are, but I will tell you, when it comes to people, you know, who are scamming registrants, I've just heard some really compelling stories about how it seems like there's a radio, police radio in the background, and it just seems so real. And that's part of what triggers this fear. So again, I think the bottom line is, if anybody asks you for money, just hang up the phone. You don't even have to stay on the phone that long. You know, if what they're saying to you doesn't make sense, like, oh, your DNA sample has been damaged or destroyed and you need to come back and give a DNA sample, yeah, just hang up on them, okay? Please, it's for your own good. Okay, let's talk about compliance checks. because it is the season too for compliance checks. And I've heard some stories recently about people showing up. It seemed like they love to put their SWAT uniforms on, and you have three, four people, maybe even more, who come to your front door and knock on it as if your house is on fire and you don't know it yet. And that was so important, you know, that you answer the door. Well, if you're on paper, which means parole or probation, unfortunately, you have to answer the door. If you're not on parole or probation, guess what? You don't have to answer the door. Okay, that's rule number one, unless they have a search warrant. So the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution does apply to you, which means there aren't supposed to be any unreasonable searches. And so, as far as I can tell, just go in, turn the music up, read a book, take a bath, just play with your dog. I mean, whatever it is that you like to do, then do it, but you don't have to answer the front door. Now, just in case you don't want the neighbors to hear that loud knocking on your front door and these people in SWAT uniforms, you might want to step out the front door. Do not invite them into your home. Okay. If you invite them into your home and they see something that might be illegal, guess what? They're going to do a full search of your home, or they can. So, and it goes to the extreme. And one of my clients, after the fact, actually, he wasn't my client yet. He said, oh, yeah, sure. I had nothing to hide. Come on in. And as they were looking through his apartment, they saw a computer. And, oh, mind if we look at your computer? No problem. Again, I don't have anything to hide. The law enforcement spent 45 minutes on his computer. And, oh, my gosh. I mean, that is... And he wasn't on paper either, by the way, parole or probation. And so the cops spent 45 minutes looking at his computer. And it's just outrageous. But he said yes. And so he gave them consent. Please don't do that. Please don't do it. I mean, if nothing else, I'm always afraid that the police are going to add something to your computer, right? Something that might be child pornography. So, folks, you do not want to let the police answer you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Use your computer. You don't want them inside the front of your apartment, your house, wherever you live. Instead, step outside. And by the way, close the front door. Chances are you'll figure out how to get back in, even if you lock yourself out. Chance, would you like to add something to that?
It's just a compliance check. That's all it is. It's hit or miss. If you're off probation or parole, as Janice says, it's hit or miss. But you know, if you want to make it, you know, a short story and you want to, you know, get rid of this whole process, you know, meet them outside. And, you know, at the same time, be aware that whatever's in plain view or in plain smell or anything like that is going to be noticed. So, you know, when it comes to your front door and, you know, your windows and everything else, just be cognizant that, you know, those things are fair play when an officer has a right to be where they are. And they certainly do have a right to do a compliance check. So, you know, just be aware of that. And also, I always think that it's good to have, you know, good relations. So, you know, a good attitude and good relations are always good. So, you know, you figure it out for yourself and I'm sure you'll make the right decision.
I think one of the things Chance is saying there is be polite. All right. So, being antagonistic, swearing at a police officer is never a good idea. Please be polite. And another thing you might think of doing is get my business card, get Chance business card, or get both of our businesses card and put them on your refrigerator. One person, the police came in and saw I think it was my business card on the refrigerator and said, oh, never mind, and left. So anyway, can't always protect you, but maybe sometimes it can. All right, so let's go ahead. A couple more announcements I want to talk about. One is meetings in person. We're trying to make arrangements here to start meeting in person in next year, so starting in January of next year. So I've reached out to ACLU in Los Angeles. We met there for many years, and I can't get a definite answer out of them yet, but hopefully in January or February of next year, we'll have our first meeting in person there. Also to have a meeting here in the Sacramento area, and then San Diego, Berkeley. We might not meet as often in person, but there's definitely some value to doing that. And the other thing folks were trying to figure out is how do we make them hybrid meetings? Okay, so how do we Zoom and have a meeting in person at the same time? Don't know the answer to that question, but we've got some tech people who are trying to figure it out for us. So, and in addition to that, next year's conference, which will be in October, we're also planning to have that in person, to have a hybrid conference. And, you know, all this is assuming that there's not another disease or pandemic that comes out. But if in fact it's allowed, we're going to have our conference in person. It's going to be at the law school in Los Angeles, Southwestern Law School, in the month of October. And so, you know, they're gently opening up their doors. And for and it's my understanding, Chance, correct me if I'm wrong here, that our conference is the biggest event at the law school. And so they're having smaller events now, you know, half a dozen people, something like that. And hopefully by next October, they'll be open to having 200 of us show up. So
that's a big event. That's a big event. And it's a nice event.
It's wonderful. Free parking in LA, if nothing else. Okay. And then the other thing is Lobby Day in here in Sacramento. So for those of you who are in California, or heck with it, if you're not in California, if you can, join us in Sacramento on March 7. So March 7, we're planning to go to the legislature, and we're going to ask them to make changes to the tiered registry law. So I do have a meeting in the office of the author of the tiered registry bill, Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco, next week, and talk to his staff about the fact that, hey, here's your child, the baby that you created. Sometimes I think of legislation that way, and it's sick, and you and it needs some help. So would you please bring this medicine to the tiered registry law? And we'll be talking a little bit more about that. But if you could just add to your dance card here, your calendar for next year, March 7, and we'll be here in Sacramento. And we're going to do things differently in that in the past, we've sometimes rented a bunch of hotel rooms, we bought a meal for people and stuff like that. What we're planning to do this time is basically give people a stipend. So if you come to the lobby day, we're going to basically hand you a check. And fortunately, we have the resources to do that. And so if you have to drive here to Sacramento, fly here to Sacramento, whatever, it's not going to make a difference. You get to choose how you get here. But the fact is, we'll be able to give you like a per diem amount. And we haven't decided what that per diem amount is yet, the board. But I just wanted to let you know, again, March 7, and if you can, start planning how you're going to get here. So I think that's probably enough announcements for now. For those of you who weren't here at the very beginning of the meeting, one of the things I'm going to ask people to talk about today is what things that you're thankful for. So let's jump into one of the first issues. And then right after that, we'll give it some thought, you know, just one thing that you're thankful for. And again, somebody earlier today, before we started recording the meeting, said he just got off of parole and he's thankful that he's no longer on parole. It could be a small thing. It could be a large thing. It could be, you know, your pet turtle, whatever it is in your life that you're grateful for. So jumping into the first issue, let's talk about the SORNA regulations. So I think we need to give some background, Chance. And so if you don't mind, I'll give the background and then maybe you can update it. The federal government issued some preliminaries and proposed regulations way back when. And unfortunately, they ignored our 30-plus page response. And by the way, that got over 700 responses saying don't issue these regulations because they're unconstitutional for all kinds of reasons. And so what happened is that the new SORNA regulations became effective on January 1 of this year. So SORNA is a federal law, and the federal law is seen as the floor of what is required of somebody on the registry. And unfortunately, that means that all the other levels of government can add to that floor. Okay. But there are certain provisions of the SORNA regulations, which are very troubling. And the one that I always point to, because it's very simple for all of us to understand, is it basically puts, it has a tier, just like our California tiered registry, but it requires some people that they would say are signed to tier three, the highest tier, to in fact register four times a year. And then the crazy thing about this is in California, the government doesn't register anybody four times a year. Okay. And so it's like, what happens? Most people in California register annually, and that's true in most states, not every state. And so the question is, well, what happens when you go to your registration office and say, I want to register three more times? And they basically, you know, kick you out of the office and say, I don't have time to do that. It's not a state requirement. Get out of here. And then you are not complying with the federal law. What in fact happens? So a lawsuit was filed by the Pacifica Legal Foundation, The alliance is in fact a plaintiff in that case, and now we have three John Doe plaintiffs as well. And there was a hearing held in September, and at that point in time, the judge dismissed the case, but said you could admit that the case could be changed, amended. The complaint could be amended. So now we have more. Well, now we have the three individual plaintiffs and Axol, and then a motion for preliminary injunction, easy for me to say, was filed as well. So there is a hearing that's scheduled on December 5th. I'm sorry, it was scheduled for December 5th, and it's been changed. So now the new date for the hearing is December 21st. Chance, what do you think the likelihood is that the hearing is going to be held on December 21st?
No, not much. This happened before. You know, I don't want to diss the judge because I think he's wonderful. Judge Bernal is a great judge and we're lucky to have him. Unfortunately, the schedule changes. If the last time around was any indicator of consistency, we're going to expect the state to change at least four or five times. If we're lucky, and it happens on that date, that would be wonderful, because we really need an answer. And I think Judge Bernal is the type of judge that makes hard calls. And he might just, in fact, issue a preliminary injunction, which is what we're really after, weighing all the equities if the right arguments are made. I don't think the government has the right argument. I think it's all in petitioner's hands. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm excited about that.
So, folks, if you're interested in this hearing, you can go in person. It's going to be in Riverside, California, 9 o'clock in the morning on December 21 or some future date. Or this is probably easier for most of us, is to basically watch it online. So I know for the first motion for preliminary injunction, I kept making flight reservations and hotel reservations only to have to change them. And there were five different dates for that hearing. And as it turned out, the date it was actually held, I think was September 26th. That date, what do you know? I was in court on another matter at the same time at a different location. So I wasn't there. I didn't even get to watch it. But this time, well, if it's on December 21, I will be there. So you can join it online or you can go in person. It is open to the public. So I agree with Chance, that judge we have in this case, it has been very reasonable. I appeared before him twice in two different cases earlier. He basically agreed with us in one case and didn't on the other, but I understand why he disagreed on the second case. So, and he has asked the federal government some hard questions in this case. At least it's been reported to me that those hard questions were asked, and not just letting the federal government right wave their hands and say, public safety, Your Honor, public safety. We need to have all of these regulations for public safety. And I guess there was some discussion, Chance, and did you actually watch it? I forget.
I did.
Okay. Wasn't there some discussion that had to do with how are registrants supposed to know if the SORNA regulations apply to them?
Yeah, there was, and the government, the government said they just got to know. They didn't say how, and they didn't say where, and they didn't say what. They just said it's up to them to know. And the judge said that's just not good enough. Right. And so yeah, there was a discussion.
I mean, can you imagine? It's like, it's going to be up to each of us to interpret every law. So you come to a stoplight and you go, I don't think that applies to me today. I'm just going to drive right through this red light. I mean, it would lead to total chaos. And so this issue too could, in fact, lead to total chaos. And that's the thing that I dislike about these SORNA regulations most of all, is ambiguity, the vagueness of it. What does it mean? And really, the number one question is, to whom do they apply? And it's not clear at all. So I can't wait. I really, really want to be there in person. We'll see what happens. Okay, so I think this is the time. It's November, right? And Thanksgiving's less than a week away. So this is the time, if somebody would be so brave here to put your hand up. You can do that either literally, though it's a little hard to see with so many people on, which is great. Not complaining about that. Or if you can put down to reactions and put your hand up that way. And if you could share with the group here one thing that you're thankful for this year, if you would. And again, it could be your pet turtle. It could be the fact that you just got off of parole or probation. I think it will help all of us to understand that there are indeed things thankful for in our lives.
And Janice, before we start, I'm just going to say, a mini example, very minute. I'm thankful for honey cinnamon coffee, which I'm going to go get right now, but I'm still listening. I just want you to know I'm thankful for it.
Excellent. Thank you, Chance.
Be back in a minute.
All right, Rick, you got your hand up. You need to unmute yourself, Rick. Okay, there you go.
Looks like I'm unmuted. Are you hearing me fine?
Yes, you are.
I'd never lived in California except for just a couple of years in the late 90s. But I came here to commit my illegal intention. And so when I got out, the probation officers didn't want me to go home to South Carolina, which is where I was actually from when I was arrested. And I was forced to do my probation here in Central District of California. I just want to say I'm very grateful for that because I've fallen in love with Southern California, and
Yay.
I don't want to live anywhere else ever. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I happen to know that North Carolina is a nice place to go to live, or at least to visit.
But, well, yeah. the probation office was not friendly to me. What happened when I was in prison, I wrote a letter to a pen pal, and he asked me, what do you plan to do when you get out? And I just joked after saying I need to find a cheaper place to live. But I joked and said, or maybe I'll decide to have an adventure and disappear. Well, the prison sent that letter to my probation officer when I was ready to be released.
Aww.
He had already agreed to have me transferred to South Carolina. But when he got that letter, he rescinded his that's why I ended up here. It was funny.
Well, we're glad that you're here, Rick. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, JD, you've got your hand up. Please unmute yourself, JD. There you go. JD?
Yep. Like I said earlier, I got off parole 8 days ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And so I'm very thankful for not having to deal with a parole agent anymore. and being able to freely go around and see family in whatever county I want to go to without you know, the 50-mile radius of travel and getting permission from your parole agent. So getting this right before the holidays is definitely a blessing. And I had a parole agent from hell, so it makes it all the more enjoyable. And it seems like the Contra Costa County's registration officers are a whole lot easier to deal with than San Jose, where, you know, there was usually a 2-3 hour wait. I had a 5 minute wait. So
wow, that's a huge difference.
But I did find it peculiar that I brought up, well, what if I want to go to San Diego for a week? And they told me that staying in a hotel is not a residence. So, like you said, I mean, that's their opinion, but you know, how do you end up trusting people? So we can discuss that obviously later, everybody.
Sure. Sure. Well, and we will talk about travel in a little bit as well. So
yeah.
Thanks for sharing that, JD, and congratulations for getting off of parole. That's amazing and wonderful. Rafael, please unmute yourself.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
As time goes by and I read the website and I read the things that you guys have been doing and I see the differences between what we have here in California and what happens in other states, in other counties, in other municipalities, I'm just amazed and very, very grateful for what you have done.
Thank you.
I just recently went for my registration again, and this time it was a little different. They had me fill out two separate forms. The lady who was a brand new cadet, I guess taking over the job, was pretty rude and didn't know what she was doing based on my experience having done it so many times. She didn't even know that what a certificate of rehabilitation was. But one of the things that was different on the two different forms that I signed was primarily that they were saying again that I couldn't get close to any school or college or any place where children or students, even if I wanted to take a internet class that I needed to register with police. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking that I have heard that here in California, we had subdued that. I went along with everything. Obviously, you're not going to rebel against anything. Well, you're there. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. But whether that is the case or not, I just realized the benefits of not having to do some of the things that they get totally outrageous about. So okay. I want to be thankful and appreciate what you and Chance do. And this is what I'm very, very grateful about this Thanksgiving.
Excellent. Thank you, Rafael. We appreciate the feedback. Marty, please unmute yourself.
Okay. Well, first of all, I am so thankful and grateful for some loved ones that are just absolutely amazing. They've stuck with me through this entire process, this entire situation, and some of them have made some great sacrifices. One of them, one of my best friends, is about to have a blessed event this weekend. I mean, I couldn't be happier for him. And he just had a milestone birthday too, and we celebrated this week. So I'm also obviously very thankful for Axol, for Janice and Chance, for Frank, for everyone else who works so hard and fights so hard for our rights. And, you know, just for us to be able to be, you know, decent people here in society. And that's exactly what we are. We're decent people. We made mistakes. We screwed up. Okay, fine. But you know what? We're still here and we're still living and we have friends right here in this community. We do have loved ones outside as well. And, again, I couldn't be more thankful for any of that. I mean, you could hand me $1 billion and I wouldn't be as thankful as I am for what I have right here. And by the way, little aside, Janice, when you get a chance, please let us know how Frank is doing.
I'm going to do that. It's going to be my gratitude. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill? Bill, unmute yourself first. There we go. I think you're muted, Bill. Nope. We can't hear you, Bill. Okay. Not yet. Yes, technology can be challenging. So Bill, while you're figuring that out, I'm going to go to Mona and then we'll come back to you. Okay. Mona, I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself.
Yes. You hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I want to be thankful for waking up every morning for the last 11 months. We got one more month to go. And for a fantastic group meeting, you, Janice, has been wonderful information for my son. He's still incarcerated. Hopefully he'll come home next year. And just a blessing for everything. My granddaughter was here from Virginia. We had a great time. My grandkids, my great granddaughter. And I'm just thankful at this moment. And hopefully it's a blessing for next year too.
Thank you so much, Mona, for sharing that with us. Dave Howe, your hand is up. You unmute yourself. Okay.
I'm thankful for you, Chance, Frank, and every single board member that gave us freedom since day one. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome, Dave. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So, Roseanne, you got your hand up? Let's unmute you.
There we go. You know what? They say that if you have problems with the computer, ask somebody under the age of 30. I do not know how to make that little hand go on the screen. Yeah. So I'm doing it old school.
Yes, sure.
Having lived in Alaska for 33 years, I found out that there are no support groups like CURE or Fearless or Oregon Voices or this that are available within the state. So my son's been incarcerated for close to 5 years. So it wasn't until I moved to Oregon that I learned of these organizations. And let me tell you, from the moment of meeting these folks, it was a feeling as if I had come home. the open arms and the acceptance. There's things that because you're speaking with people that have walked a similar path that you've been on, there are things that you just don't even have to explain. And just the kindness of people. It has been amazing. I did have, and I do have, an amazing support group in Alaska, as well as through my family, and I'll always be grateful for that. But this group of people that I'm meeting for the first time that have just said, come on in, what do you need? How can we help you? How, you know, it's just, how wonderful is that? How wonderful is that? Just people showing up and being there to help in any way they can and share their knowledge, share their experience, and share their journey. And that has been a gift that I will always be grateful for. So thank you. Thank you to you.
And thank you, Roseanne. That was very heartfelt. And I'm cheering up here. But quite frankly, that's why we're here, folks. We're here to do exactly what Roseanne was talking about. And we're here to support you. We do it in these monthly meetings here. We talk about laws and regulations. And, you know, we're using a lot of things with our brains. The emotional support group meetings that Marty talked about earlier, those meetings are about your heart. Okay, they're talking about feelings. And some people, you know, they call me and they're very emotional and I try to help the best I can. But I have to say, I'm a counselor with a little C, right? So I'm a lawyer. I don't have any credentials when it comes to counseling other than being the mother of two and a former Girl Scout leader. So yeah, we're here to help you. We're here to support you. And we're here to give you hope. Most of all, we're here to give you hope. And, you know, Chance and I may not be able to solve all your problems instantaneously. In fact, we probably won't be able to, but we're here to give you hope and to help you guide you on a path. And so many times, you know, in these meetings or even on one-on-one conversations, what I do is I lay out your options, right? And then it's up to you to make your decisions. And sometimes there's risky behavior and, you know, like the spectrum of risk, and you get to decide where on that spectrum you want to be. Where do you feel comfortable? I mean, we all take risks every day. If we get in our car, we take risk every day if we walk across the street. So some risks are more manageable than others, though. So don't stay in Nevada longer than 48 hours. Okay, that's Janice's commercial. Okay, John, you got your hand up.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to just reiterate what everyone else has said. I appreciate everything. I'm kind of new to the block, and I've connected to the Axel support group. And I'm donating small checks to you every month, and I'm going to continue doing that. And I'm entering the University of California law program in January, hopefully to somehow become an advocate and help others. And I just wanted to say thank you and keep up the good work.
Yeah, that's a very fine school you're entering into. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And Jeff, did you say you're going into law school?
I'm entering a paralegal. I've got two graduate degrees, so I'm entering a paralegal program at UC Irvine. It's all via Zoom, and then I understand that I have to be even with your registry, you have to send in the forms, you know, even when it's not on campus. So
I think it's ridiculous, but please do it anyway, just so you don't get in trouble.
Okay. Well, anyway, thank you so much. I appreciate all.
You're everything. Welcome. Yeah. And I will just say that I'm aware of many people on the registry who've gone through paralegal programs, and they've been able to help lawyers, and especially criminal defense attorneys who, many of them, they want somebody who's been involved in the system, who knows the system from the inside. So I'm encouraged, Jeff, and I want to encourage you to continue your work. Congratulations. Okay, John, you had your hand up. You want to mute yourself now?
Good morning. Good morning. To see everybody again.
Morning.
I'm grateful this year for two fairly major events. Jan became a grandma recently. And
that's your wife, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And her daughter and the grandbaby are doing fine. And my number two granddaughter had her little one a couple of months ago, and we got to see her about 2 weeks after the baby was born. And they're all doing well. So I'm really grateful to see that the two newcomers to the world are in good hands. And I'm really grateful to you for being in my corner. You have a way of calming the rough seas when when things are getting a little chaotic. And we're in the middle of my petition, and this tell you all, you're in good hands. Not the Allstate commercial, but it's almost like that. Janice does a good job keeping a lid on things. Anyhow, thank you.
You're welcome. Very much. Thank you for that. And just, you know, it's out there. Unfortunately, the DA's office has objected to John's petition. So we're going the hard and steep path here. But I think we can get her done. Okay, Brent, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Doing great.
Good. I'm thankful for Axel Support Group and for you and Chance, specifically you. You helped me a great deal in the past few months. I'm also grateful for my family supporting me with this difficult process. It's been a challenge, and I'm still nervous. I got a big deal on the 16th of December, so I'm nervous, but thank you for all your support.
And thank you, Brent.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Joe Simonson, Foundation Board Member.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am so thankful for loving family and friends that have been very supportive over the past 30 years. It's been a little rocky sometimes, but, you know, when you've got a family that cares about you and loves you, it makes all the difference in the world. In fact, I'm going to be leaving here tomorrow to go up to Oregon to spend a few days with my daughter, son-in-law, and the grandsons, and that's always something I look forward to. Also thankful that about 10 years ago, discovered, and, you know, it makes so much difference to know you're not in this by yourself and to have a support group that is advocating for us, fighting for our rights. It's a blessing. So thank you and everyone that's part of it, that's online, that's supporting right now. It's great to support each other and be together and know we're not alone.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate that endorsement. Bill, you have your hand up again?
I'm good to go now. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
You can hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go
ahead. Okay, great. Yep. Okay, fantastic. Yes, I'm thankful for my two support groups in addition to this one. So I really have three support groups. The other two are COSA, which stands for Circles of Support and Accountability, and SAA, which is Sex Addicts Anonymous. And all three of these groups give me encouragement and hope, and I'm thankful.
Well, thank you, Bill, for that, sharing that with us. And you just said something that triggers in my mind the name of Frank Lindsay's book, We're All in This Together, right? And quite frankly, that's what's going on here. And a couple of people have asked about Frank Lindsay's health, and I want to let you know I'm happy to report that Frank is well, or is certainly on the way to good health. It was almost surreal when Frank was diagnosed with COVID. And one of the reasons is Chance and I, we had actually 21 people in a board meeting all day long. On November 5th, I believe it was, the first Saturday of this month, we were all together all day long and meeting with Frank Lindsay. He was one of the 21 board members. And the fact is that just 2 days later, he was diagnosed with both COVID and pneumonia. So, and Frank is 69 years old, and he also has been smoking for more than 50 years. And quite frankly, when he went from being in critical care to being in intensive care and on a ventilator, I thought we'd lost Frank. I really did. And that's why we put the request for thoughts and prayers for Frank. And I am so happy to report that Frank is out of intensive care. He's not on a ventilator. He's back in critical care, which is a step in the right direction. And I actually got to speak to him about 48 hours ago. So he let his daughter know that he wanted to talk to me. And, we just mostly, you know, shared pleasantries, but, he couldn't talk for more than 5 minutes. But I will tell you, during that 5 minute time, Frank found something to argue with me about. And I was so happy because that's Frank's personality. If Frank had enough energy and, you know, he was coherent enough to think about something to argue with me, that means really Frank is on the mend. So, I think he's going to be in the hospital for a while longer, maybe even another week. They're not going to release him until he tests negative for COVID. And I think that's a good thing for Frank and for others. So, wow. it was just such a shock to find out that Frank was so sick, really within 48 hours of us spending the day with him. And we did have one person, unfortunately, that he shared his COVID germs with. And fortunately, that person seems to have a mild case of COVID. They actually spent 4 hours on a car together. So the rest of us who spent a day in about 8 hours in meeting, fortunately, none of the rest of us contracted COVID.
That meeting was interesting and also interesting in a way that, you know, it's a miracle that no one else did contract it. I remember at the end of the meeting and just before I left, sitting across from Frank and talking to him. And, you know, probably for about maybe, I don't know, 5-10 minutes. And I knew right away something was wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on it. He just wasn't himself. And, you know, so when we talk about things we're thankful for, I am thankful for his recovery. We've had other board members that have gone through surgery for cancer that are recovering well. I'm thankful for their recovery. And I'm thankful for the fact that no one else was infected with COVID, and the person that was is on the mend. And so there's a lot to be thankful for, and really quite miraculous, all told, really quite miraculous. But I know a lot of people were thinking about them and praying for them and supporting them. And I was one of them, and I know Janice was, and the whole group, you know, the whole group, board, the foundation, the board of directors, everybody in unison. So I'm thankful for that.
And we thank you all for your prayers and thoughts as well, because we know that that is what healed Frank, because otherwise he had so many things, you know, going the wrong way for him, all these comorbidities and such. So it's just a miracle. So, yay. Lots of things to be thankful for. And thank you all for sharing, the folks who did speak up. I see on the chat version over there, there's some other people as well who've shared things that they're thankful for. So thank you so much for that. So let's go on and talk about the military veterans case here. And just for those of you who are new or relatively new, a quick synopsis of this is we have people who have spent 20 years or more on active duty in the military. So they're not just veterans like me. I spent 4 years on active duty. But they, in fact, are retirees, military retirees. They spent 20 years of their life basically protecting our nation. And now they are being denied access to military bases solely because either they're on the registry or they were convicted of a sex offense, a few specific sex offenses. And it makes me mad as hell, quite frankly, that this is happening, because, I mean, I made a different decision. I decided the military was not a career that I wanted to pursue. But the fact is, you know, I respect greatly so many people who did, in fact, make that choice. So it's very upsetting to me that after people make this significant contribution, their life, right, their career, that in fact the benefits that they have been receiving for so long have been taken away from them. So we have, I've heard from so many people all over the country about this happening to them. It seems to affect every military service. It's not just one. I'll tell you, we'll share one example. I did help somebody who was trying to get on to into Balboa Hospital in San Diego, California, and he was being treated for cancer, and he went there for his treatment, and they wouldn't let him on base. And you know what? I refused to take no for an answer in that situation, so I called the hospital, and they were upset and outraged about it too. And so between the hospital and me and yeah, we got him on base. Okay, but that has been a rarity. And he has a very limited pass to get on the bases, basically get himself to the base hospital and get off. That's it. But for him, that's all he did. Another gentleman who I helped get a one-time pass for, he had his RV and a boat that were being stored on a military base. And all of a sudden they were telling him he couldn't get on base. And, you know, of course he wanted to move his boat and the RV if in fact he couldn't get access to it on a regular basis. But we went ahead and filed a lawsuit on behalf of a registrant here in California to try to get him access to a military base. This man had been getting military medical care for over 50 years from the time he was in high school, and he was on part of ROTC. Then he was on active duty. Then he was a base contractor. I mean, 50 years. And after 50 years, without any notice whatsoever, he was denied access to a military base. And he lives pretty close to this base, and he was relying upon it for medical access. So I think it's wrong, and we filed this lawsuit. And unfortunately, the government filed a motion to dismiss the case, and even more unfortunately, the judge granted that motion. So that just happened recently. In fact, we were supposed to have a hearing yesterday on the case, and the judge said, "Nah, I'm going to make this decision without your oral argument," which happens sometimes. I don't think that reflects upon the value of the case, but we're now doing our best to try to figure out how to appeal this decision and or file other cases in other locations. So that one was filed in Federal District Court, Central District, which includes Los Angeles. And so we're looking for other jurisdictions where we can file a similar lawsuit. I think it was the wrong decision. The judge basically said, oh, no, it's not a benefit. It's a privilege. Because it's a privilege, the base commander can do whatever they want. But really? I mean, the person, the plaintiff in our lawsuit, you know, his victim of his sex offense was not military. It didn't happen on a military base, and it happened more than 30 years ago. It's like, what the heck are you worried about, base commander? So it, you know, it wasn't a decision that was based on really anything reasonable. So that's why we filed it. So I'm talking to a couple of other people, including one on the East Coast. We may just go ahead and file a lawsuit. And there's some other people too. So people who are like military, disability, and you don't necessarily have to have put in the 20 years if you were disabled because of your military service. And so that's another possibility. And I think that they actually have a stronger case, quite frankly, because it's in the law that says you will have these benefits, whereas it wasn't ever in the law before for the military retirees, but it was just what was happening. And it happened for a very long time. I mean, more than 50 years, right? So anyway, it's unfortunate, that decision. But it's not the end of the road for sure. And does anybody have any questions about it? And if or any comments to make about it? I'm looking over there and in the comment section, or chat room, there are people making comments. So I would think we won't go there. Well, why don't we just go ahead and move on to the next, situation, Chance, and you're such an expert here, and I'm going to go get my cup of coffee. We'll talk about travel, domestic and international, if you would start that out.
Well, sure. Okay.
We do have a hand up here. I'm sorry. Maybe it's about the other issue. Dan, your hand's up.
Yes. Just wanted to quickly comment on the military retiree. I'm a 20-year active duty veteran of the Marine Corps, retired in 96, and access bases and stations worldwide to include the United States without a problem. My offense occurred in 2008, but I was still allowed access. I didn't find out about it until November when I tried to access Marine Corps Base Quantico. They took my ID card, won't even let me on base to talk about it. So I just quit going there. I live in upstate New York, and I am able to access a military installation up here. I simply had to go to the provost marshal's office and speak to an investigator. I filled out some paperwork. He wanted to make sure that I was not under any type of supervised release. Mm-hmm. And then that was the end of that. Now, every time I go through, when they check my ID, there are questions. And I simply mm-hmm. tell them, I've already talked to provost marshal. I'm cleared to come into the base. And that's the end of that. Thank you.
You're welcome. And maybe you can explain, Dan, when you mentioned these bases by just the name of the base, Quantico, I think, is Marines. But the other one that you mentioned, what service is that?
The Marine Corps base, Quantico, is of course, Marine Corps. But the other one was an active duty Army fort. So.
Okay. Well, I'm encouraged to hear that you were able to persuade the Army to let you on base. And I don't know if that's a one of, or if in fact other people are having similar experiences at Army bases, but it's good to know that as a data point. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Okay. Time to move on to travel, Chance. And if you would, as I said, start it, I will get my cup of coffee and I'll be right back.
All right. Happy to do that. Let's start with domestic travel. As opposed to international is anything beyond our borders. Domestic is within our borders, state to state, not necessarily within a state we're talking about now, but traveling from state to state or interstate. interstate commerce. So what the bottom line for that type of travel, you know, just at base, is that every jurisdiction is different in their requirements. So for instance, if you're going to leave California and go to Nevada and go to Las Vegas, they have a certain amount of time before they require a out-of-state registrant to register in their state. Other states have similar requirements, but different time periods. Some states accumulate time so that you can only go there so many times and build up so many days before you can't go again. Others require that you check in, and there's like a shadow registry where you let them know who you are, but you know, basically they don't run it through the process and you let them know when you're leaving and they trash it. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on and it's so different from all, you know, from just every corner of the country. But, you know, if you're going to plan a trip, the key thing to remember is wherever you register at, whichever state you register in, you don't want to register in any other state, especially states like Florida. There are states, and I'll just use Florida as an example, that will keep you on their registry forever. And that's a problem. Now, there are some lucky folks that will litigate that and maybe get removal, but that's an expensive proposition. And the best way to avoid that is not to register in those states at all, which is to say, understand where you're going and what's required of you in each state and avoid staying there long enough to register, or leave the state and come back to it so that you toll the time, so that you don't have to register. That's the basic rule of the road in domestic travel. Now, before I move on to international travel, I'm sure that people have some questions, and they're much more interesting than what I would say, you know, in laying out the issue. Does anybody want to ask any questions before we proceed on to international travel? I'm looking for hands. I'm looking for hands. I see none. Okay.
Well, whoops, Chance. Before we leave domestic travel, just really, I think the biggest message here, folks, is to plan ahead. Okay. So I don't know about you, but I get calls sometimes and somebody goes, I want to drive across the country. Right. And I'm like, okay, you know, can I do that? The answer is yes, but you need to plan ahead because it's really important. And I'm sure you said, Chance, I'm going to repeat it. It's really important that you don't register in more than one state. And then there's some states like Florida and New York where you virtually are on there for life, regardless of whether you ever go back. So it's just much better to plan ahead so that you can avoid registering in any other state. Thank you. That's my
thanks. Commercial. Thanks for that, because that's a good emphasis. I would reemphasize that 1,000 times if I could. Any questions before we move on? Yes. This is Roseanne. Unmute. How do we unmute you, or do you unmute you yourself? Let's see. Can you unmute yourself?
Because I can. Oh, there we go. Okay. And this is new to me. So when you say make sure you're not registered in more than one state. So let's say somebody is living in Oregon and they're registered here, and they want to take a trip to two states and only stay a couple of days.
Right.
So as long as they're within the parameters, if that state says you must register if you're going to be here more than 3 days, so you make sure that you're just shy of that. But if you're going to stay there longer, let's say it's for a holiday, does that mean that you tell Oregon, I'm going to be in this state for 2 weeks, so I'm coming off of your registry and going on theirs?
Well,
and
no, then you've got
to switch back. I'm not sure I understand that process.
Yeah, I mean, your question is a good question, and I think a lot of people get confused about it, and because it's confusing sometimes. But you've got it right. What you want to do is you want to plan it out, and the first thing you want to do is find out what the requirements are for the states you're going to visit. An easy way to do that is just to go to our website and get started there. We have a resource section. You can kind of see where the law is at that moment in time, but remember, law is dynamic. And because law is dynamic, it changes. And so what you want to do is go from our website actually to the web to see if there's any updates in that particular state for that particular law. But let's just say that you can stay for 3 days and you went to our resources and you looked, you know, on the web to see if it was updated or has changed. Seems to be out-of-state registrants 3 days before they have to register. Okay, So if you visit that state, you want to stay shy of those 3 days. Okay. Now you want to check to see if there's cumulative time in the state, because if you want to stay longer, all you have to do is leave the state and then re-enter, and that starts the time period again. You want to do that, if you can, depending on what the law is in that particular state. So that's important for you to know. You do not want to register in that state. Okay. Avoid registration. It complicates things. And again, the examples of, say, Florida and maybe New York too, is that once you register, you're on there for life. And so let's just say you live in California and, you then registered in Florida because you were going to be there for a while, not really understanding that, you know, when you left and you thought you were deregistering out, you were permanent. And that really screws you up, because if you get relief in California, you're still pinned down, you know, by that registry in Florida. So it affects you in, for instance, in many ways, but for purposes of our example, we're going to go to international travel next. It will affect you in international travel. It will really impose on you. So what you want to do is you want to limit, where you register to where you actually live, the state you reside in. And you want to make sure that when you travel, that you build an itinerary and you look at other states and know how long you can be there. And if you want to be there longer, know how to retoll it, if it's possible, depending on that state. And enjoy your vacation without the stress. Enjoy your time without the stress.
And Roseanne and others, I mean, there's a wide variety of time requirements here that trigger registration. And so the shortest one that I know is Rhode Island, which is 24 hours, right? And so the thing is, you know, you can still have Thanksgiving at Aunt Sally's house, but it might make a sense to, it's a small state, it might make sense to get a hotel room outside of Rhode Island, right? Because there are states nearby where you can stay for 5 or 10 days without having to register in that state. So that's why Chance and I are always recommending people plan ahead. There's ways around most of these things and stuff. And you know, then there's other things like, we have to talk about it, Chance. We do every time. Las Vegas, okay? So the state of Nevada is 48 hours. That's the whole state. And so people ask us all the time, well, what if I go to Las Vegas for 48 hours and then I'm going to go to Reno for 48 hours? No, they're in the same state. So please don't do that, because you're basically taking a risk. And remember earlier in this conversation, this meeting, I talked about, you know, there's risk. There's small risk on one end. There's large risk on the other end. And the problem is, if you basically trigger one of these registration requirements and you don't register, you could be convicted of failure to register in another state, right? And you create this requirement. And as you know, Florida and New York are the two major states where they don't take you off, except I think we have to say this too. This is a footnote. One of our Axel board members who was actually originally convicted in Florida, he just got off the Florida registry. So I can, anybody that wants that information, I can tell you about a wonderful attorney in Florida who at least got one person off the Florida registry. And now he's got a different issue here in California. So it's not that he doesn't have to register anymore. It's the fact that he doesn't have to register in Florida anymore. And so, you know, for him, it was different because he was registered in Florida first. And so it wasn't a matter of him going to Disney World in Florida and that triggered the requirement. I've listened to a lot of sad stories about that. And I'm sure you have too, Jans, right? But the fact is that, you know, he was convicted there. So he got off that registry and now he's only in Florida, in California rather. And so we want to keep you all off these registries. And as we, why don't I just go ahead and start talking about travel overseas, because there's a really nasty federal law out there called the International Megan's Law. And so our organization challenged this law. I was actually the attorney arguing this case, and I was not successful. And our challenge was not successful. So it makes no sense to me. And I'll just say it one more time with the good old International Megan's Law, that it requires people who, if you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and this does include child pornography, by the way, it's not just hands-on offenses, plus you're required to register in any state, or if you're on any state registry, that means that the federal government can put a unique identifier on your passport. And to me, that is the worst part of the interaction Megan saw. There are other bad parts, but it just, because it just reminds me that of Nazi Germany, quite frankly. In Nazi Germany, you know, they put a very large red J, meaning that you were Jewish, on your passport. Okay. And the only other country in the history of the world that did that was Russia. And again, they did that to identify people who were Jewish. And, you know, I remember asking at the time, both in writing and in oral argument, why do we want to be a member of that club? No other country puts unique identifiers on the passports of their citizens. And it just seemed like a really awful and terrible idea. And you know, we had a judge who was very unsympathetic, also a judge who had not traveled overseas very often. She said really stupid things. This is the judge testifying during the case, right? And she said, oh, well, the only time you ever use your passport is when you enter another country. And I immediately knew she hasn't traveled much overseas, right? Because when you go to another country, you're showing your passport on a pretty regular basis. You know, it used to be when you went to the bank to exchange money. Nowadays, you can do most of that with your ATM card, right? But you know, you go to a hotel, the first thing they ask you is, where's your passport, right? So, I mean, it's really, that document is really important. And then I remember the federal government attorney was testifying, and she said, oh, it's no big deal. This unique identifier, it's going to be at the back of the passport on something called the endorsement pages. I didn't even know there were endorsement pages on a passport until she brought that up. But anyway, it's like, oh, okay. Well, guess what? It's no longer there. The unique identifier has moved like from page 27 of the passport up to page 1. So now when you open the cover of your passport, page 2 is where your photo and passport number is. Page 1 has a unique identifier, which says this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. And then it has a citation to the U.S. code. And it's like, what does that mean? It doesn't say what our age of consent is, because in some nations, the age of consent is 12. And a lot of our people who've been convicted of a sex offense, you know, their victim was 15, 16, 17, which is totally legal in that country. But they just say, oh, it says unlawful. Okay, that must mean it must have been age 10, right, for a country where the age of consent is 12. And then it said, then it doesn't say how long ago was that, did that happen? And I always think about Frank Lindsay, who was convicted more than 40 years ago. But it doesn't say on Frank's passport he was convicted in 1979, right? It just says this person was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. So, I mean, that's one of the things that gets me very irate, because it doesn't define the terms. And so the countries then are defining these terms in their own way. And so we have many countries now, unfortunately, including the continent of Asia, with only one exception, is denying entry to everybody who has who's on the registry. I'm sure you have something to add, Chance.
Well, the message that the stamp and the passport sends is don't admit. I mean, that's basically the message, and it puts people in a really precarious position. But you know, the reason I think. This is just what I think. The reason they came up with the stamp is because there is no federal registry. It's just a patchwork of all the registries across the United States. And so when you look at the federal database, the feds rely on each database in each state, which could be up or down at any given moment. So when you travel internationally, especially, let's just take, for instance, if you're going, you know, by air, the manifest is checked to see if anybody registers. And two protections that the feds wanted to put in there to make sure that they didn't miss anything was, one, 21 days notice, so that you're actually snitching yourself off, and two, a stamp. So if you can't snitch yourself off within 21 days of travel, you can certainly open up your passport. And as the feds found out in many countries, and I can attest to this myself, because I've represented expatriates for the last 10 years, all over the world. I've been around the world at least 50 times in the last 10 years. And I can tell you that when they open up your passport in many countries, they don't go too far, especially to the end of it. So it's, you know, so I think that these machinations were done in order to make sure that nobody fell through the cracks. Unfortunately, it's a horrendous thing to do to anybody who's traveling, because it puts them in just a horrible position once they hit that country, either to be excluded or two, to be exploited. So it's horrendous.
And thank you, Chance, for that. And it also has a disparate impact, quite frankly, on members of the LGBTQ community. One of the plaintiffs on our case he was born in Iran, and he's lived in the United States ever since he was 7 years old. And his father still lives there and still has property there. And his father's elderly, and he's concerned that, you know, when his father, toward the end of his life, he would like to go back to Iran. And he said, no, he's a gay man who was convicted of a sex offense. He says, if I show people in Iran my passport, I'll be killed. So, I mean, think about that. You have to decide between going to your father's deathbed, and much less to inherit the property, right? Or be killed. And so he's really caught between a rock and a hard place. So thankfully, so far, his father's been well, and he's not on his deathbed, but he's thinking about what's going on. And he's very much concerned that he will have this terrible decision to make sometime in the future. And we had another plaintiff, by the way, who was married to a woman who's a citizen of the Philippines. Married. They've been married for a long time, certainly before the International Megan's Law. But after the IML came about, he can't get into the Philippines, and she can't get to the United States. I doubt if they're still married, quite frankly, because that lawsuit was filed 6 years ago in 2016. But it's that kind of thing that happens. And by the way, the fact that you're denied entry to a country, it costs you a lot of time and it costs you a lot of money. And I know a family that was trying to go to Central America. I'm just forgetting the country, but they were going to Central America. They had their, you know, lodging paid for. They had all these things all set up and stuff. And they checked in, their luggage was checked. And as they were getting on the airplane, basically the flight attendant said no to the registrant. You can't go. And he's like, excuse me? So his family decided to stay with him in the United States and not go to Central America. But boy, did they lose a lot of money. But I even know people who've gotten on an airplane back to the Philippines, a different gentleman who was going there because his wife is Filipino and a U.S. citizen, but they were going to back for some big family event. And he got to the Philippines and they said, no, you cannot enter this country. And so it's a long flight, right, Chance, to get to the Philippines from the United States.
About 15 hours, yeah.
And so he had to stay in the airport until the next flight out, and then he was basically shipped back to the United States. And he couldn't even communicate with the people who were waiting for him outside the airport. I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible thing. So these are the reasons that we're sharing this information with you. We want you to avoid this. And I want to say in the positive, there are some countries in Europe. There are 26 countries in Europe. They're called the Schengen Nations. They have this coalition. And trust me, it's not principally about us and our issue, but they're smart people and smart countries, and that they go, oh, those crazy Americans, you know, they're so hung up about sex. So it's a miracle that we procreate, right? So the fact is that they let people who are on the registry come visit. And I'm happy to report, because I am Italian, that one of those countries is Italy and France and Germany and Spain. So those are the four large countries in Europe that allow registrants to visit. I'm not saying they'll let you move there. Of course, they don't most of us move there. But anyway, you can go visit. And then there's 22 smaller countries. And, you know, Europe's a nice place to visit. So please don't think that you can't travel anywhere, because you can go to those 26 European nations.
Yeah, thank God for that. It's nice to know that you can get out and travel. My family comes from Kyiv. I'm not sure I want to go back there right now, but I think that the Schengen countries are wonderful places to go, been to many of them, and, you know, just a fantastic way to spend your time. So, you know, be cognizant of that and know that there's places to go and things to do.
Thank you. This is a time, folks, if you have a comment or a question about either domestic or overseas travel, you've got two experts here, Chance and Janice. This would be the time to ask questions or make comments, please. If not, we're going to move on to the tiered registry in California. Waiting.
Okay, it's a Thanksgiving crowd.
All right. I've got a turkey waiting for me. Okay, so let's do talk about the tiered registry law. It's so fascinating, the time that we spend here in Sacramento. And by the way, I moved to Sacramento 5 years ago because of the tiered registry law and other laws too. And besides, I have some family that live in the area as well. So, you know, we lobbied for 7 years approximately to get a tiered registry law passed. The law we asked for, we didn't get. So we asked Chance and I and all the other people who came to Sacramento to lobby, we asked for a registry that was based upon risk, not based upon offense. We got one that was based on offense. We asked for a registry that would put people convicted of CP possession and other lesser offenses on tier one. We didn't get that. Okay. But what we did get was a registry where some people are eligible to petition for removal, and in fact, those petitions are being granted. My understanding from a California DOJ letter is over 4,000 petitions have been filed in the first year of petitioning, and of that, at least half of them have been granted. A very small amount have been either denied or dismissed, rejected because of eligibility, really. And so progress is being made. And I know I was able to get my 49th client off the registry on Monday of this past week, and it felt damn good. My goal is 100. So I'm halfway to my goal. Well, and I think I will achieve that goal, if not surpass it. But the fact is, there's some other things that are going on in the tiered registry that are not right. Where do we start? I'm going to start with the TBDs. So a large number of people are basically been told that their tiers haven't been assigned yet. And we didn't know how large that number was until last week. And so one of our board members was very kind and submitted a Public Records Act request, which we can all do. It's kind of like Freedom of Information Act, but it's on the state level. And so he asked that question, how many people have you not assigned yet, California DOJ? And their number was 12,400 and a few. So almost 12,500 people who haven't gotten tier assignments. And the fact is, my experience with filing a petition where the tier hasn't been assigned is the court just rejects it. Okay. It's not that they're denying the petition. They just reject it. They basically say you're not eligible because California Department of Justice hasn't assigned this person to a tier, to which I call bullshit. Okay. And I say that, and that's makes such an emphatic statement because that's what it is. So remember I said that we didn't get the type of registry we wanted. We wanted it to be based on risk level and not on tier, on offense level rather. And so I had a client who had a misdemeanor offense. So Penal Code Section 647.6, which is annoy a minor. It also says something else, but I prefer to think of it as annoy a minor. It was a misdemeanor. It is a misdemeanor. Still is a misdemeanor, right? And that was his offense. And unfortunately, when his birthday came up, he didn't have a tier assignment yet. I went ahead and filed his petition, and the court rejected it. And so we had to wait like another 6 months until California Department of Justice got around to assigning his tier. You know, and it's crazy making. And of course, the person that I go to most of all is Frank Lindsay. He was convicted in California in 1979. Folks, that's more than 40 years ago. And his tier hasn't been assigned yet. And by the way, when he got so sick recently, I swear, one of the things that made me so angry, I thought the man was going to die on the registry. And I'm like, no. And I filed Frank's petition in January of this year because we had to wait for that birthday rule, right? And in January of this year, the court rejected his petition because his tier hadn't been assigned. So here we are 10 months later, and we're still waiting for Frank's tier to be assigned. And again, the big number here is it's over 12,400 people. So Chance and I, we don't let the bullies get to us, right? So we, and this time the bully is California Department of Justice, we are going to file a lawsuit in January. Okay, and I don't want to thank you, Dave, for that fist pump. And, you know, I don't know about you, Chance, but I always feel a little nervous when you're going to sue a whole agency full of lawyers, but you know what? Sometimes you just got to do it. Well, and it doesn't hurt that we had success before.
The law really is on our side. I mean, it's not like it's a huge roadblock. I mean, there are parameters. And, you know, when DOJ just can't do whatever it wants. There's legal mandates out there. So they've got to abide by those. And if they don't, then they're going to have to come up with a really good reason why not. And if it's not good enough, they're going to have to do what they're supposed to do.
Thank you. So our interpretation of the tiered registry law is that California DOJ has to have every tier assigned by December 31st of this year. Frank's birthday, by the way, is January 5th. So when Frank goes to register next January 5th, if his tier hasn't been assigned, we're going to drop the bomb. Okay. The lawsuit's already going to be ready. The question is who the plaintiffs are going to be. I have two other plaintiffs as well and all ready to go. And, you know, the law says that DOJ had an additional 24 months to assign people's tiers, especially the ones, you know, who were convicted in federal court, who were convicted in another state, who were convicted in military courts, to try to figure out what the comparable offenses here in California. By the way, they have to do that anyway. They have to make some determination about whether or not somebody has to require to register in California. So why the heck is it taking them so long to figure out what somebody's tier assignment is? If it's offense based, you basically choose the offense, you identify the offense, you look at the chart. We have charts, and it's like, oh, there you go. It's on, you know, a person's on tier two. Frank Lindsay should be on tier two. It doesn't take a rocket scientist. It doesn't even take a lawyer to figure that out. And yet a whole agency full of lawyers haven't figured out that Frank Lindsay belongs on tier two. So on behalf of Frank and 12,400 people, we are going to file this lawsuit. If you happen to not have a tier assignment and you want to be considered to be a plaintiff in the lawsuit, please feel free to contact me. I'll just go with you through this process and try to figure it out. If in fact you're eligible, if you don't have a tier assignment, by the way, you're probably eligible. But we just have to get California DOJ to pay attention to the law themselves and do what needs to be done. And the history of this law, by the way, remember I said we worked on this for 7 years. We started in the year 2010. So that's how long ago we started this. It took 7 years to get the law passed and signed by the governor. So that was 2017. I mean, literally 2017. And then California DOJ whined and complained and said, oh, well, it's going to take us a long time to get tiers assigned people and stuff. So we need 4 years. And that's what they got. And actually, they got almost 5 years. So from 2017 until 2021, I guess that's four. In fact, they had 4 years in which to assign people's tiers. And by the way, they got 60 new employees. Now imagine what you could do with 60 people. That's like, I don't know, Joe, is that an Army platoon? You were in the Air Force. I don't know. That's a heck of a lot of people. 60 people, full-time employees, and it's taken them all this time. Now it's 5 years, and they still don't have every tier assigned. Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but I think it's outrageous.
Yeah, this is, you know, I'll kind of do a comparative here of what I think is the problem, because I think that, you know, one, it's not really understanding what to do and really not very good preparation or training. It's kind of like this. Janice mentioned that some of these petitions have been rejected. And I know that the problem is that the way that it's set up is rather easy. The instructions are easy and it's pretty easy to file these petitions. The problem is that there's a lot of moving parts here. And when you file the petitions, just because you file them and do what you're supposed to do doesn't necessarily mean that where you submit that petition, the court, the jurisdictions or whatnot, are going to know what to do with them or how to proceed because it's so new. It's like if you have a car, you know how to drive it, right? But if it breaks down, it's very difficult. If you don't know how to fix it, it just sits there and stops. And so, for instance, in many of the cases that I handle, you know, time goes by and I've got to inquire what's wrong here. And often it takes a trip down to the court to make sure that, you know, they have everything they need. Sometimes law enforcement sends their CSAR reports to me. Sometimes the proof of service is lost and no one says, hey, where is it? And, you know, and all kinds of things happen. Same thing happens at the DOJ level. So you've got this new law. You've got a whole lot of stuff that people just don't understand. And it gums up the works. It shouldn't. especially at the DOJ level, because they have the budget and they have the people. And, you know, it doesn't, it's not too hard to train them to do these specific things. So less of an excuse there. Okay. As far as jurisdictions and courts and everything, a little bit more difficult.
There's been all kinds of crazy things happen under the new law. I've had to instruct judges. I've had to instruct the clerks. You know, one clerk, after the judge granted the petition, she wouldn't give us a court order for 3 months. And she always had an excuse. And I'm like, does this person who happened to be a woman, does she hate people on the registry and she doesn't want people to have the court order? I mean, what the heck is going on here? And, you know, I was tempted to file a lawsuit against that clerk, and I thought better of it. So, of course, I didn't do it. But in some jurisdictions, actually not that one, but in some jurisdictions when things go a little sideways, we found out a letter to the head clerk of the court helps. And they're like, oh, really? You know, kind of like, I have an employee who doesn't know the rules here. Let me help them, or whatever they do. But we get what we need. So it's been kind of a moving target. I think as the process has gone on, that more and more courts are doing the right thing. They understand what it is they're supposed to do and when they're supposed to do it. I had one city in Los Angeles County. I'm just going to mention by name, Montebello. In the beginning, the registration office refused to make a determination whether somebody was eligible. So after the petition gets filed, then law enforcement has up to 60 days, but not more than 60 days, to determine somebody's eligibility. And they just refuse. And I talked to the city attorney, and I talked to everybody else, the police chief, and they just wouldn't assign somebody, you know, make that determination. So we filed a writ of mandate, and then they did it. So fortunately, we haven't had any other problems with Montebello or any other town in a city. I mean, that's an extreme example, but there have been some interesting situations going on.
Yeah, I just have to mention, I was in court yesterday for further proceedings in Los Angeles. Hmm. And in Los Angeles, they parse these things out. So felonies are handled by the district attorney, misdemeanors by the city attorney. But you'll notice on the forms when you petition, there's no place in the process for city attorney. It doesn't exist. So there has to be a handoff between the DA's office and the city attorney's office. And I was in court for further proceedings. I mean, we're really stretching it. And it was really funny because, one, the DA refused to even acknowledge that there was a petition. And two, the city attorney came in with no petition, no file, no nothing. So apparently there was no handshake. I approached the judge, and, you know, I looked at his file, and it was pretty slim. And I said, look, you got a really slim file. Let me help you. Because the night before, I made duplicates of everything to make sure we got this thing back on track, including an order. And that order I was hoping to get granted that day by default. But the city attorney was gracious enough to take a duplicate I made for them and set a short time period of review so that they and indicated that, you know, they probably would not oppose it. It's, again, fixing the car under the hood. You've got to, you know, and that requires sometimes having to go to court and educate everybody about the process, because further proceedings just don't cut it. So, you know, it's new, and things like this are going to happen until people get educated in it.
And then we have petitions that get filed and the DA objects to them. And, you know, I've had three of them so far, and I've been successful in all three. But I've got one, an ugly one coming up in December because this is an example. I contact the deputy DA, and, you know, just like usual, you strike up a conversation. Hey, you know, what's the basis for your objection? And the answer I got was, because we can. And I'm like, that's interesting. Because we can. You're going to get to explain that to the judge, because you can. Because the fact is, the burden of proof is on the district attorney to prove, this is the language from the bill, by the way, the law, that, let's see, community safety would be significantly enhanced if this person continued to register. So beyond the statutory requirement. So again, if you're on tier one, it's 10 years, tier two, it's 20 years. And I've got a client who's been on the registry for over 30 years, and they're objecting to her petition based upon what happened more than 30 years ago. And, you know, we're explaining up one side and down the other to the judge that that's not the way things work. But when a petition gets denied, it puts it really into high gear, because it's no longer you know, filling out those forms, like the 415 form, the petition form, making sure that he gets served properly, and then you follow the proof of service, all of a sudden you're in high gear. And this is you. And when I go in, I'm going to come in with every resource I have, which includes a psychological evaluation. And so the psych eval that gets done by a PhD psychologist, you know, we get letters of support. We have the person, the petitioner, write a letter to the judge. And it's kind of like the old certificate of rehabilitation process, Chance. I mean, at least that's how I treat it. And so far, I've gotten good results in doing it that way. And I will say so far, too, the DA's offices don't seem to be taking it that seriously. They just want to wave their hands like they used to do and say, oh, it's community safety, judge. Therefore, you should make this person continue to register. And so far, in those three cases, all three judges have said the DA did not meet their burden of proof. And that was music to my ears. But in order to get there, it cost a lot of time and cost a lot of money. Psychological evaluations are not cheap. The top expert, and I think you use him sometimes too, Chance, Dr. Malinick, he's now charging $8,000 for psychological evaluation.
Well, you know, this is, you know, there are doctors out there. And when I look at a case, and I handle complex, you know, a lot of complex petitions, it depends on what I'm needing. You know, some people just need a simple risk assessment, which can be done for very little. Some people need a medium range evaluation, which could run roughly around $3,500. But in complex cases where risk really is at the forefront of this whole thing, Dr. Malinick is the guy, and he's expensive. And he's expensive because he's worked for the prosecution now for most of his career, and he's well respected. And that means when Dr. Malinick speaks, people listen. Okay. And so on those really hard cases where it's complex and the issue of risk is really a viable issue, you know, when it really is up front, Dr. Malinick is the go-to guy. So it really, it really depends on where you are on that spectrum as to what it's going to take to do these things.
I agree. And I do have an expert who will charge about $1,000. So just like you said, Chance, if it's low risk, you know, the case is not complicated all the way to, oh my gosh, this is really complicated, then you want to bring in heavy firepower, I guess, using a defense analogy there. So folks, how about questions people have, or maybe they have comments about the tiered registry law here in California? I did mention earlier in this conversation that it bears repeating that March 7, we're going to be lobbying the state legislature to fix the tiered registry law. There are changes that need to be made. And, you know, the one example I keep going to because it's so important is people convicted of offenses involving child pornography. So the child pornography offenses right now, if you're convicted of a felony CP offense that can't be reduced to misdemeanor, that's a tier 3 offense. And that means you're on the registry for life. The weird thing about this is the feds under SORNA, they put federal CP possessors in tier 1, their lowest tier. So I don't usually point to the federal government as a good example, but except for this, right? It's like, oh, well, look at this. Here they put the CP offenders down on tier 1. And if you're on tier 1, you only have to register for 10 years, right? And then it's much easier to for a judge to grant your petition. So another thing we're going to do in our lobbying effort, so if anybody is on Tier 3, please come join us, because one of the questions we're going to ask the legislature is to create an off-ramp for people on Tier 3 so that it's no longer impossible for you to petition for removal from the registry. And in many states, that is available. And by the way, it's probably going to be in the beginning after 30 years, provided that you haven't committed another sex offense. And so I know that's a really long time, but it's less than lifetime, number one. And number two is later on, we're going to go back again. We're going to keep lobbying this legislature for improvements to the tiered registry law until they have it right. Because one of the things, like with the CP offenders being on tier 3, it was nothing more than a political compromise. That's it. Right? Those, you know, behind closed doors, in the smoke-filled rooms, that's what happened. There was a political compromise that put the CP offenders up on tier 3. The good part about that, Chance, is it's not based on any solid reason. And so it should be easier to convince the legislature, you know, to reduce the tier.
Yeah, the thing is, and Janice said originally, is that you know, what we wanted is a risk-based tier system, a true tier system. And what we got was something quite different. But nonetheless, malleable, okay, because it can be worked. And what we want to do is we want to take it from the law-based, you know, the conviction-based model it is now, and we want to move it over to the risk-based model. And that way, it gives everybody an even chance, because it is our fundamental belief that there's only a very small percentage that pose that kind of risk. And therefore, an off-ramp is justified as the needle moves over to how the tier should be looked at. It should be a risk-based, because if you're going to say that people pose a risk to the community and you judge it on convictions only, you miss the whole point. The whole point is it's based on risk, and then it becomes just an intellectual falsehood, okay, which is what we're working with now, which should help us when we go to legislate, help us form these kinds of arguments that people can really understand and understand how it is to be smart on this, you know, and instead of buying into this myth and you know, doing things that are just going to slow up the progress. And I think that we have a very good chance of moving the needle here.
And I agree, Chance. One of the things is there's a legislator who told us to come back in 2023 to make changes to the tiered registry law. He knew it wasn't perfect, but he really wanted us to wait. I mean, we didn't wait. I remember we were there in 2018 trying to make changes right away, and they said, no. We have to see how the petitioning process works. So it's been over a year now. In fact, it started on July 1 of last year, the petitioning process. And one of the things that they're looking at, quite frankly, is, well, what happens to these people? What do these people do after they're removed from the registry, right? And thank God, another thing I'm thankful for is people who are getting off the registry are not committing new sex offenses, right? So, folks, this is really important, okay? When you get off the registry, be really, really careful. Don't leave yourself on the side of a highway. Unfortunately, that is a sex offense, public and decent exposure. You know, just be really careful that you don't reoffend, because it affects not just you, but the whole community here. So, yeah. So anyway, this is a good time, if you have a question or a comment, to raise your hand either virtually or on the photos here, because I think we've just about covered this, Chance, unless there's something else you need to add.
No, that's it. I think we're good.
Okay. Oh, here's a hand that's up. John, please, sir.
Good morning again. Speaking about urinating on the side of the highway, I've had 3 minor strokes that have been diagnosed because my portions of my brain melted when that happened. And it really affected my bladder control. And when I get the urge, like if I don't find a stop on the highway, I'm in trouble. I'll have my seat of my pants and everything will be all wet. So I carry one of those pee buckets that they use in the hospital. And I've had to stop numerous times. And I use that between the doors on the hidden by the highway off to the side of the road. So I'm just saying that. That may be a good excuse if you do get stopped. Like, so what are you doing there? And I just let them know you. In my case, I'm prepared to let them know that I've had strokes and I should probably get some medical verification to carry with me. But that's how I try to get around that issue. Just a suggestion.
Yeah, it's a good idea, John. It really is. And I'm sorry that you even have to think about it, but it certainly saved getting convicted of another sex offense. Gary, you got your hand up? Gary, can you unmute yourself, please? No. Let's give you another minute here, Gary, to unmute yourself. And if you don't, oh, there you go.
There we go. Are there any other organizations in other states besides California that are working the tiered registry requirements?
You mean in their own state, in that different state?
Yeah, like I'm in Colorado.
Okay. You know what, Gary, I know that there are affiliates of the National RSOL. So if you go on their website, again, National RSOL, you can just Google that term. And then they have a list of affiliates. I happen to know there's two organizations in Colorado. I'm not really aware of what they're doing recently. I hope that if you don't have a tiered registry in Colorado, that they're working on it. And if you do connect with somebody there, you can just, if you would, tell them about Chance and I, and we'd be happy to talk to them about our efforts and what it took.
All right. That'd be great. Thank you.
You're welcome, Gary. Thank you. And Jeff, you have your hand up?
Quick question. I wrote it out. If we're unable to make it on March 7th, I know it's several months off. Is there anything else we can do to assist you?
Absolutely. Thank you. You're like my straight man today. You can make a donation, a financial donation to the organization. That's always possible. Also, we'll be asking people to write letters of support. So right now we're at the process of trying to find an author for the bill. And hopefully that's going to be Senator Wiener. My pitch to him in his office is, hey, you created this thing. Now you need to fix it. Right? It's kind of like a child that has a fever. Come on, you need to come and fix it. And so once we have a bill, then it's a lot easier then to go ask people to support a piece of legislation rather than just a general concept. So I think that we will find an author. I hope it's Senator Wiener, but we shall see. But thank you for that question. Also, so donation, financial donations, letters of to legislators, and we will tell you who the legislators are. They will be members of the Public Safety Committee in both the Senate and the Assembly. There's been a new election, but they don't choose their committee chairs and stuff until January. I think they're going to keep the same committee chairs, but I'm not sure, and the committee members. I hope Senator Wiener stays on the Senate Public Safety Committee because he's more powerful there than if he's not a committee member. So we just kind of have to wait, and you know, we're preparing behind the scenes. And so in addition, I want you all to know that in addition to our organization, we're reaching out to other organizations too that are natural allies. I don't think I should mention those organizations quite yet because they haven't signed on for support. And of course they won't sign on for support until there's a law. But anyway, so financial donations, there will be letters to write, there will be phone calls to make, sometimes even emails that can be sent. And we will share that information with you on the website. And then the other thing is already on the website, you can sign up to get text and email notices. So if you want to know about things like, hey, you know, please write a letter. It will happen in early next year. We're not at that point in time, but yeah, it's coming soon. So thank you for that question. Thanks. And as far as the donations, I mean, we do all the work that we do is based on private donations. We have applied for grants in the past, and so far we've been unsuccessful getting any of them. What a surprise, right? Sorry, sarcasm. Frank, got your hand up?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. I just have a quick question. Is it possible to have your tier reduced if you just had your felony reduced to a misdemeanor?
Yes. Well, in some situations, I've had success with 311.11A, which is possession of child pornography, and people who've been reduced from tier 3 to tier 1. Is it that offense or is it a different offense?
It's a different offense.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I'll pull out another one, sexual battery, which is 243.4. Unfortunately, at this point in time, the DOJ is not recognizing those reductions. And we think that is really wrong. And that's one of the things we're asking Senator Wiener to help us with the legislation, clarifying that if your felony has been reduced to misdemeanor, you automatically belong on tier one.
Okay.
So Frank, why don't you call Chance or I privately rather than having it on a recorded meeting like this about your specific situation, but we'd be happy to do what we can.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bloss, you have your hand up? Bloss, can
yeah.
you?
There yes. You go. Janice, good morning. I just want to have a question with regards to what is the criteria of the DOJ to assign, in the tier? Because as far as I understand, some people prior to this new law, you know, petitioning for together from the registry prior to this. Some people were assigned to tier two. And now, when this law has been passed, those people who are in tier two are now assigned to tier three. What are their criteria for assigning, those people, in the registry,
Hans, do you want to take that?
I'm not sure I'm really even understanding that, because before the new law was passed, there wasn't a tier registry. So I'm not sure I'm understanding the question.
I think maybe the question more is, Bloss, I'm sorry, I muted you again. Maybe you can unmute yourself, because Chance and I want to make sure we understand your question. I think the question more is kind of like, how do you negotiate with the California Department of Justice about what tier you belong on? I've done it through letter. And so I've been able to help some people on tier three because of CP possession, but always in those cases that their felony was reduced to a misdemeanor. And it's a 311.11A. For the others, the only other thing that I can think of is through writing a letter to California DOJ asking them to reconsider the tier. Because to me, Bloss, the law is very specific and it says, if you were convicted of offense, blah, 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 then this is a tier to which you're assigned, right? And that's why it's so crazy making why we're waiting for California DOJ to make tier assignments for over 12,000 people when most of the time, at least this is how I feel, Chance, I don't know how you feel, but I think I can do it in 10 minutes. So, you look at somebody's life scan report, their civilian rap sheet, and you go, oh, okay, you're convicted of this, that, and the other, and blah, blah, blah. Okay, and you're not on parole or probation, you're eligible to petition for removal because you're assigned a tier, you should be assigned a tier two, and it's been more than 20 years. But
I mean, there's that, and then there's nuances, like, for instance, if someone's on tier two for, say, a 288A, little lascivious, and they picked up it's an old conviction, but prior to that conviction, they picked up, say, another offense, maybe just a misdemeanor offense. Maybe they didn't register for it. And I'm talking about things that happened, way back in the 80s, 70s or whatever. The law discusses things like that, and it eliminates people from contention even in tier two. So it really is, you really have to investigate this. And a lot of times I ask clients almost all the time for a live scan so I can do it myself and understand it better. So everybody's different in that way. Each individual has to be assessed in that way. There are very simplistic things that are easy to look at and conclude on. And then there are some complicated factors that take a little bit of analysis and everything in between.
I'm now looking, we have 20 more comments over in the chat room. Okay, thank you, Bloss, for your question. And Brian, I see your hand up.
You're welcome.
Okay. Brian, you want to unmute yourself, please? There you go.
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. My question is about what happens behind the scenes. So when you file your petition, you file everything correctly, it goes to the courts, you get the law enforcement responses filed, the district attorney's response is filed with the court. Then what happens in the background? And the reason that I asked this question is I filed a petition like 8 months ago and it just kind of sat there and nothing happened. So finally yesterday I went down to the courthouse and I talked to the clerk to see like if I could figure out what was going on. Mm-hmm. And she said she wasn't quite sure. And she was going to have to look into it. She took my phone number. And then yesterday afternoon, she called me back and said that she spoke with the research attorney. And the research attorney had told her that they didn't know what to do with my case because it seemed my case was a federal case and it was more complicated, they said. So they just didn't know what to do. So it was just pending because they weren't sure what to do. So I wasn't familiar with the term research attorney. And I just was wondering like what happens in the background.
Well, that's a very good question. And this is something that we were talking about earlier. You know how to drive the car. You filled out the petitions. You just don't know how to fix it. And, research attorney, every court has research attorneys and judges refer things to them all the time. There are attorneys on staff that outline and do analysis for judges and such, but, you know, not for clerks. And the thing is that if they don't know what to do with it, probably you should be speaking to an attorney, because otherwise it could end up sitting there for a very, very, very long time. And a federal conviction is a complicated matter, and it has to do with sentencing and a whole lot of other things, because most federal convictions are felonies. There are no misdemeanors in the federal system. However, the DOJ has made some decisions based on their discretion, based on sentencing factors. And so it really, when you have something a little bit more complicated, you really should see counsel.
Ryan, do you have a tier assignment?
I do. It's tier one. And I've been on, it's tier one, and I've been registering for 24 years.
Yeah.
That's, you know, Brian, talk to Chancellor I directly. That's a mess that should never have happened.
Yeah, it looks like DOJ already made its decision. And, you know, now it's under the hood. This is where things have to be fixed at the filing level.
And Brian, yeah. What county do you currently reside in?
Fresno.
Oh, Fresno. Okay. Please call Chancellor I. Fresno is its own beast, quite frankly. And I believe that every petition I know of in Fresno has been objected to.
So. Yeah, I got the rare. Mine was actually, I have a non-objection from the DA. So anyway, I'll call one of you.
That's weird.
And the court hasn't granted your petition? Oh, my God.
No, it's 8 months ago.
That's just way beyond.
Please call Chancellor Ray. I think we can fix it for you.
Okay.
Okay, Roseanne, I know you've had your hand up for a while. Please unmute yourself. Let us know what you want to talk about.
Hi, thank you. I'm new here, and I just forgot to say this before. I just wanted to bring something to your attention that doesn't have to do with the tiers, if that's okay.
Sure.
My son in Colorado, you might know that the FIRST Act has gone through, that people can use the classes that they have taken or classes that they're teaching. And for every 30 days that you have been in classes, you can either get 10 or 15 days taken off of your sentence, and it's cumulative, right? So my son went to his case manager, said, just want to check in where I'm at. And he's a Lolo. And he said, Scott, according to your record, you are like the worst person on the planet. You've had all this hands-on offenses, which was a total lie. And the counselor knew that, the case manager knew that. So he said, give me a few days. He was able to clear that off of my son's record. He said, however, I found through my counterparts across the country that thousands of those who are incarcerated, their records have been altered.
By who?
That's the big question. So apparently this has been before the legislature since 2018. It finally has been enacted. And so now people can use this to reduce their time. And so far, his accumulated time has not been reflected on his, you know, whatever, the part of the internet that I can look at. But when the case manager said that thousands of people across the country have had their records altered,
I don't know about that.
That's a problem.
Well, no, it may not be a problem, because people these days tend to say a whole bunch of stuff they don't know anything about. How would they know that?
So, you know, that's, well, yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that if the case manager said that he's spoken to his, and you're getting this third hand, so take it with a huge grain of salt, please.
Right.
You know, but as a family member, you don't want to do anything that's going to cause retaliation for your loved one, right? And all this kind of stuff. So you try to be careful how you move forward, but maybe he's spoken to his counterparts in other countries where they're, you know, people that they're a case manager for, they have found the same thing on their records. Anyway, it was on my son's, and it had to be removed. Who would have gone in to manipulate my son's record, right?
So, Roseanne, I'm going to stop you right there, because I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but I'm really curious about this. So I am in the chat room, everybody. I put my name, my email address, and my phone number. And that's one of those things, Roseanne, that I would ask that you contact me directly, and then we can start looking into it. I mean, okay. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I just, like, I'm so curious. And then there's, you know, there's some other things, like, and this is way different than what you're talking about. Let's just say in the state penal code, there's penal code section 647.6. I mentioned it earlier. It's a misdemeanor offense, and it's on tier one. And I call it annoy a minor, okay? But that's not the whole title of it. And I dropped part of the title on purpose because it says annoy or molest a minor. But in that situation, the molest part is not, even though it says the word molest, it's not a hands-on offense, all right? So, honest to God, I have a client who said, you know, stopped at a stop sign or stop light, and you know, in the crosswalk, two young women walk in front of him, and he just, in his car, he is in his car. He rolls down the window, and he yells out, hey, baby, got great tits. He was convicted of 647.6 for molesting a minor. Well, annoying or molesting a minor. I think it was annoying that he said something like that. I mean, I remember being a teenager and people saying inappropriate things, but you know what? It's like, does somebody belong on the registry for the rest of their lives for that? Of course not. So I'm just wondering, it's possible. And we have this problem too, Chance. I'm thinking with our California Department of Justice and these profiles on the Megan Saw website. So sometimes the subsections change. And so I've had a category of people in California who did not have, their victim was not a minor, but because the penal code section changed the title of it, but they didn't change it for him or them. And so it changed. So it says that the victim was a minor when it wasn't a minor. I mean, there's in at least two cases I know of. And so the question, so maybe something like that happened. It might've been an innocent, we'll call it an innocent mistake, but still it bears some digging into, and I'd like to dig into it. So thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, do we have any more questions or comments? We'll just call this free time. It doesn't have to be about the tiered registry. If you have any questions or comments, again, I hope everybody heard it. If not, I'm going to repeat it. Frank Lindsay is doing remarkably well. He's no longer in the ICU. He's no longer on a ventilator. I spoke to him about 48 hours ago. He could speak on the phone only for 5 minutes, and they're giving him some physical therapy to help build up his strength. And he's still testing positive for COVID, unfortunately. So they said they're going to have to wait until he tests negative for that. But I think it's a miracle, again, given that he's 69 years old and has smoked for over 50 years. And he had pneumonia at the same time.
Yeah.
Other than that. And I'll just mention the person, Chance mentioned briefly, we have another board member who was in the hospital this week. She was diagnosed with cancer. She had her surgery this week. I can't believe they sent her home the same day. It's major. She had breast cancer and had a double mastectomy. And so she's home. And I guess there must be people taking care of her because that's major surgery. I know I have a sister who underwent that. And and my sister, but it was a long time ago. They kept her in the hospital for quite some time. But that's what hospitals are doing now. And it's been something that's been heavy on our minds of having two board members, you know, face major health obstacles like that. And I'm going to turn around. I'm grateful for them and that they're healing. I'm grateful for my good health. Chance, anything you want to say in closing here?
I just want to say thank you for joining us and, you know, have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday and we'll see you back.
Thanks, everybody. Take good care. Bye-bye.